Accession number 10308, Reel 1.
Mr. Marchant, Reel 1. Where were you born, Mr. Marchant?
Born 14th September 1920.
Whereabouts?
In Hull, Yorkshire.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was a wholesale fish merchant on St. Andrew's Dock.
Where were you educated?
And I was educated at the Boulevard Secondary School, Hull.
How did you come to be in the forces?
I was conscripted, like many of my age group, in 1941, January 1941.
What was your reaction to being conscripted?
Looking back, initially I was very unhappy at leaving home, but then fairly enjoyed the life in England. Not really looking forward to what the future held, but fairly enjoyed the life in England.
What was your reaction towards the war? Can you remember?
Oh, yes. I really did think, like a lot of people, that it would be over before I was involved.
Why did you think that?
I suppose we'd grown up to think that Britain was invincible. I don't really know. But that was the memories I have of it. That Britain was a big, powerful country still, and nobody would last very long against them. And this was a fairly common belief among the young people, I think.
So what was your reaction in May, June 1940, when the Germans launched their blitzkrieg against France and the Low Countries?
Well, even then, it's difficult to recall my memories of that. But I still had the impression that things would really come all right. Yes.
Which unit did you join?
The Royal Engineers at Ripon. Did my training at Ripon in Yorkshire.
Can you tell me how you got out to the Far East?
Yes. I had a friend, Johnny Morton and myself, and my name being Marchant and his being Morton, we were always together. We met on the train, he from Newcastle and me from Hull, as we were going to the training depot. And we became buddies, fairly obviously. We were always put on guard together, etc., etc. He finished in the training group, number one, and I finished number two. And we were both offered officer cadre courses. We talked it over, and we both decided to go in for it. And the rest of the unit were posted, and we were put on special training. And if I put it rather crudely, the bullshit was so terrific that we both resigned. So the CO called us in and said, well, he said, there is a war, and as you say, but you have to go through all this. What do you want to do? So we said, well, we don't want to carry on with this. Oh, he said, I'll see you get posted. And we were both posted together to the 287th Royal Engineers Field Company.
In what way was the bullshit so bad?
Well, they would take you out with all your equipment, even in a war, fully blancoed, polished and everything, take you on a route march, then drop you in the mud and say, now, and when you got back, you had to be on parade in quarter an hour, all bulled up again, all that sort of thing. And we complained that, well, there was a war on. Was this necessary? So we were keen to be doing something useful, it would appear, at the time. But if we thought differently, we may have taken a different line of action.
Can you tell me how you went out to the Far East with the 287?
Yes. They were part of the 18th Division, and we sailed, I can't remember if it was Gourock or Greenock, but a Scottish port, and we sailed on the Duchess of Athol, called the Drunken Duchess, because it rolled terribly. Everybody was sick, and Johnny Martin and myself were never sick. We lived like fighting cocks. We went straight across the Atlantic to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and this was in end of October, maybe early November 1941, before America was in the war. As usual, we had a little code to send home with the data, etc., of where we were going to tell our parents, because your letters were censored. And we had no code for America or Halifax, so our parents didn't know till we eventually arrived in Singapore and a cable was sent home. Then when we came to Halifax, Nova Scotia, we were marched off at the middle of the night and put on American troop ships. And America was not in the war. This quite fascinated us. And they fed us like fighting cocks. Absolutely great. We had a wonderful trip right down the east coast of America through the West Indies. I can remember now seeing flying fish and so on and so forth. We didn't get any leave till we came to Cape Town. We got 2 days' leave there, which was very good, and contacts I made there, they wrote to my parents throughout the war and sent them food parcels. Very kind people. I have nothing against the South Africans in that sense. But that's politically so, but not so anymore. Then, after we left Cape Town, the news came of Pearl Harbor. And the Americans must have expected some sort of trouble, because I can remember them putting Oerlikon guns onto the rails and practicing and so on. And then on Christmas Day, we got to Mombasa. And I remember that day particularly well, because we were on the American boat and they had a wonderful Christmas meal organised, and they brought it up too early and it all went bad. So we had bully beef and onions, I can remember, for Christmas lunch in Mombasa. Also, the brothels were out of bound, I remember that. Then we all went aboard again and went across the Maldives Islands, picked up water, then into Singapore.
So there was no enemy action against you on the way?
No, none at all. We got to Singapore without interruption.
What was the morale of of you and the people round about you when you arrived in Singapore?
Quite buoyant, really. But they gave us, I can remember being given a lecture. They took us ashore and we did one route march and they gave us a lecture. And they told us, it was ridiculous, but it's a fact, they told us that all the Japs were small and short-sighted and couldn't shoot straight. And we then all thought the officers were fools for telling us that, because otherwise, well, I can remember thinking this and talking to Johnny about it, saying our officers must be fools, you know, to tell us things like that. It's ridiculous. They couldn't do what they've done if they were like that. So it was obvious that they were trying to build up our morale, whatever our morale was like. It's funny how certain little things stick in your mind. I remember that very well.
Was it your own officers from 287 who told you
that? I think it was, yes, in a get-together which they gave us all. And then we, of course, then trained into lorries and we went up into Malaya.
What was the situation in Singapore from what you could see?
Well, I would have thought it was a bit chaotic. The Japanese planes seemed to fly over at will. There seemed to be very little resistance from what little air force there was. And they dropped the bombs just when they wanted. This is what it seemed to me.
Did you see anything of the European civilians there?
Very little, because we only remained in Singapore for maybe 2 or 3 days, I try and remember. And then we were, as I say, we were in lorries and we were way up into Malaya.
When you say we, was this just...
The 53rd Brigade, we were the only part of the division on that boat. The rest of the division were going to the Middle East, and then they came in very much later on a boat called the Empress of Asia, which was sunk, I believe, when the fighting in Malaya was over, and they landed just in time to go on to Singapore, which seemed a bit ridiculous, really. But so the 53rd Brigade, which I think was the Norfolks, were the infantry, the CAMs, the Royal Engineers and the artillery. They were sent up country to nearly as far as Batu Pahat, I remember.
What was your journey like?
The journey wasn't very good, because there was a lot of strafing going on. And I can remember, well, I thought, well, if there's going to be, having remembered about what happened on the continent, if there's going to be any trouble with aeroplanes, I'll volunteer to be the lookout. And I sat on the top of the wagon, on the sheeted cover, and nominated myself as aircraft lookout, because you could jump straight off then into the jungle. So already the art of self-preservation was coming to the front, shall we say. And several times that did happen, and I can't remember where they established their headquarters, but I remember our section was detached from the rest, and we went up through a Chinese village with a river called Yongpeng, and the whole of our section had, being Royal Engineers and being a retreat in progress, we had demolitions to do. And we were sent furthest forward, number 2 section, Cockney, I can remember who was with us, and we had a position in a cutting fairly near the coast, and we had it mined, and the news came, and it was accurate obviously, because they knew what they were doing when they told us to mine it, that the Japs had landed small tanks and were coming down the road to cut off the rest of the units, and that's obviously why we were there. So I can remember well waiting, and the officer came and said, wait while they come to the top of the hill. And then we blew it and destroyed the first tank. And then we went in a lorry, and each bridge back to Yongpeng, the main road, we blew. to slow them down, but it didn't slow them down for very long, I don't think.
What was your own particular role in all this?
I was a sapper, and my job was helping with the demolitions, of course.
But what specifically would you do to help?
I would help to load the aminal charges and put in the cables and do the general dog's body work, while the NCO would keep an eye on the fact that you did it correctly.
You say that it failed to slow the advance, but how was the actual work performed? Was it performed efficiently or not?
Yes, but the Japs, yes, the roads were blown up and bridges were blown, but the Japs are excellent at sort of putting bridges across, walking round roads and going through the jungle, and we were not. We had, I believe, one compass. We didn't leave the main road. We'd be lost in the jungle. Dreadful. That is why they had a comparatively easy time. Nobody was trained in jungle fighting. Like, later on, we learnt about Burma, where the English people were trained specially for it, if you remember. They were ever a bit of a match for the Japs. I suppose we would have been if we'd been trained for it. But all we were trained for was desert warfare. Terrible, really, when you think about it. And nobody, I think there was one, the officer had a compass, and I think the section sergeant had a compass. Every Japanese soldier had a compass. Every Japanese soldier. And we seemed to be overladen with equipment and so on. There were, in fact, if I remember rightly, we still had gas capes, which we threw away, actually. And our rifles, if you put them down with the old Lee Enfields and the bolts became muddied up and wouldn't fire, the Japs were hooded with a sliding top, I can remember. And they could drop theirs in the water and they could bring it out and fire it afterwards.
Hooded with what?
They had a sliding metal, well, the top of a Lee Enfield. You lift the bolt up, which is the rifle, pull it back, it's open, you can see. The Japs was all covered over with a piece of casing, if you like, and it just wasn't affected by mud, so they could keep firing. And there's a lot of mud and water about, obviously, in those parts of the world.
Were you aware of all these deficiencies at the time, or is it only with reflection that you realised?
I suppose on reflection or later, because I certainly didn't know about the Japs till I saw them. And in fact, until one or two of the English-speaking Japs said that the English equipment was no good. And I can remember the Bren carriers of the infantry going along, and they were tossing hand grenades in from the trees. And in the end, they put up sort of tents, wire netting, which bounced the hand grenades off again. That was an open Bren gun carry on a road with jungle either side was a death trap.
When and where did you see that?
I actually saw that not far from Yongpeng. I only saw the carriers, and we were told the reason, because obviously I wasn't an infantryman, and we were told the reason for it. So it was quite, seemed to us that the equipment wasn't suitable for where we were. And I can remember the Singapore State Volunteers, one of them coming back all shot up with armoured cars that had been in the desert in 19, I forget what date he said, but after the First World War. And they just wouldn't keep bullets out, the Jap bullets out. And they were wiped out to a man, just about. A lot of the equipment was very inferior. I can remember also seeing, and it's in one of the books which I have, and it's a fact, I've got it underlined. I remember seeing a Gypsy Moth fabric-winged aeroplane with a pilot going over, and he was tossing hand grenades out. Ooh, that takes some believing. Hedge-hopping. And he was from the Singapore Flying Club. That's almost unbelievable, but that's absolutely true. I remember it coming very, very low over where we were.
So how did morale hold up when you got into this kind of situation?
Well, I think overall our unit's morale was fairly good, but it was obvious that there was going to be trouble. I remember thinking, well, really, I said to Johnny, there's going to be a lot of trouble here. I don't think anybody's going to have a chance. And really they didn't, and it seemed to be that sort of feeling all the time. They were very badly prepared, the British. Very badly prepared.
Did you see much in the way of casualties at this particular time?
No, we did have one or two casualties. I remember the first casualty the company had was Bob Duke, and he was at the side of one of these roads. Bob Duke, that's right. And he was they were strafed, and he got a bullet through his thigh or leg. And I believe he's a survivor, actually.
What happened to you next?
Well, we were withdrawn after that first week at Yongpeng, and the rest of the unit was sent up. They were cut off, and then we were told it was a forced march towards Singapore because the Japs were overrunning the place. And I can remember very well Brigadier Duke, who was in charge of the our particular unit, I presume the brigade. He walked about with his tin hat and a machine gun, and he said, anybody that throws any equipment away, he said, I'll shoot them. I can remember that very well, actually. And, of course, nobody threw any equipment away, and I just happened to be unlucky at the time. I was carrying the heavy machine gun, and my pal was carrying the ammunition, but we didn't drop it, may I say, because he was a man of his word, I believe. Anyhow, I think we marched a day and a night, and we reached some rendezvous on the main road, and they took us back over the over the causeway into Singapore, where eventually the balance of our unit joined us because they'd been further up country. Then the first job they gave us was blowing up, I can't remember which one it was, I think Salita, I think, airport. They'd already had natives there digging long trenches in the ground, and we had to go along at night time, I remember, and very quietly put the charges in and wire it all up, and it was blown up the next day, so they couldn't land the planes on it. And then they used us as infantry.
What kind of positions did you take up?
Our position was on a hillside overlooking the road, which was adjacent to the reservoir. That was, I've cut out the bit where we're in a camp, and I don't know what happened. The Aussies were infantry and all the rest of it. But then they used everybody's infantry. And it was a ring round Singapore. And the shelling was heavy. There were no British planes. There was practically no water. I think the artillery had run out of shells. And I can remember saying to Johnny, well, this is it, where we've got problems. And I can remember, I can see our trench now, and the Japs are supposed to be coming over at the other side. And I remember that Johnny and myself, we'd put two machine guns in and four rifles and all this sort of thing, just in case. And there were a few casualties there on patrol. I'm trying to think of the name of the people. But patrols used to go out into the front to see, give us information about the Japs. I can remember one of the patrols was badly beaten up, shot up, I think, and wounded. But we actually, although we heard the Japs and was firing ahead, we never actually made contact with them as infantrymen. Thank God, really, I suppose. Because by then, it had got desperate and the capitulation came. I remember somebody riding down the road with a white flag and coming to our officer's place. And they told us that we had to pile our arms by a certain time in the afternoon and so forth, and that they'd packed in because there was no chance at all. It was just going to be slaughter. The civilians were dying by the hundreds every day, I gathered. Water had been cut off. There were no aeroplanes, and the ammunition was low. So I can remember well, we unscrewed the bolts off our rifle heads, the head off the bolt, and then we threw all our rifles into a pile. There was a hell of a row with that, apparently, but because when they got them, they were useless. Also, all the ammunition was dug away and hidden. And I remember we were told to try and get books or whatever we could, because they didn't know what captivity would mean. And that was where I picked up that notebook. And I picked up another book, I forget what it was, to take it in to wherever we were going, libraries.
What was your reaction to the fall of Singapore? Did you feel that it was necessary or not?
Well, I felt it was a disgrace from the beginning, personally. Honestly, that's not just hindsight. I can remember one or two of us talking and saying, well, fancy a place like this, defended as it was. No aeroplanes. Disorganisation. Almost a rabble, it became.
Who did people tend to blame?
I think that's unit to which you belong, the government. It was always the government, this or the government, rather than individual men, I think. Because obviously the guns, for example, couldn't support you in Malaya. I'm sure everybody's aware of that. And we also blew up some of the big guns which were facing out to sea. They only faced out to sea. The planning was totally and awfully wrong for Singapore. Nobody thought there'd be an attack from the land, you see, from Malaya.
Did you personally blow up any guns?
One, yes. We were sent to one of the guns to place charges, and of course it was detonated and blew the breeches.
Do you know where that was?
No, I can't tell you the name of the place.
Oh, what kind of...
I can remember we were at Nisun Village. I'm trying to remember the names. Nisun Village, but I don't think there was a gun. It was a naval gun, a very big gun in a concrete emplacement. And it wouldn't swivel to the north. It wouldn't angle. I'm not an artilleryman, so I don't really know what all that is about. But they wouldn't swivel to the north, and they were trying to destroy them. I don't know how many others they blew up, if they blew any up. But those are two things I remember, blowing up the airfield at Salita, I think it was Salita, and one gun. That's all I was involved with, personally.
And it was blown up successfully?
Yes, as far as we're aware.
What was your actual first sight of Japanese troops?
Well, we'd seen some in Malaya, but apart from that, we'd seen them coming down the road before we blew. But apart from that, they're an unshaven, ragged lot. Very tall, just the opposite of what they're told. Mainly, I would think, in the 6 foot area, really. Very lightly clad. Unbelievable. Not carrying much equipment at all. Everyone, it struck us, had this watch with a compass on the other side because they showed us them. And at the time, they were quite a roughish lot. They weren't too fussy about what they, you know, pushing about, etc. And after our officers had received the information to to capitulate, we had to congregate in certain areas. I couldn't tell you where they were. And then we had to start the march to Changi. Initially, everybody was sent up to Changi, the big, long trail of prisoners of war marching up to Changi, and they were allowed one motor, I remember, per unit, and ours was filled with company office records and food, and we all picked up what we could. I remember putting tins of bully beef and packs of cigarettes, things like that, in my pack instead of the ammunition. I filled it all up with food and a spare pair of socks, all the things that you thought in your own mind you might need. And we set off and marched through Singapore right up to Changi. And the wire eventually, and they just left them there, and we were left to our own ends.
What was the march to Changi like?
It was dispiriting. There was no cheer, nothing. They all had the Japanese flags outside because they changed colour as soon as the conquerors came. I remember row after row of the villages with the white flag with the red fried egg, as we call it, in the middle. And it was very dispiriting, and everybody was very weary, and you'd sick people, you'd all that sort of thing. And you didn't know what was going to happen.
How did the civilians react to you as you marched through?
Mainly very subdued. I think perhaps then, and I'm sure they did later, perhaps with hindsight they started to realise then that they're going to have problems, because I suppose some hoped that the Japanese were better to get on with or better for them than the British, but it didn't turn out that way.
Did any of them show any anti-British or anti-white hostility?
No, mostly they were just mainly quiet and subdued, as I remember it. Mainly quiet and subdued. Were no laughing or that sort of thing, I know.
Were these Malays or Chinese?
Some Malay, but mainly Chinese, who were, I found out later, were really turned out to be pro-British later on. But then again, they were the Chinese, with hindsight now, that wanted independence and fought against the British afterwards. So whoever was in charge, the Chinese would be anti. So they were certainly anti-Japanese. The Malayans tended to be more pro-Japanese. They were a rather indolent crowd. And I think ending for a peaceful life, whereas the Chinese were far from that. Far from that.
Can you tell me about Changi?
Yes. It was a Selarang barracks, if I remember rightly. And we, in fact, our particular unit, we were put into wood huts with atap palm leaf roofs, which had been used by Indian troops. And the big problem was the Japs were pressing on, as I remember now, the Japs were pressing on to Indonesia and Java and Sumatra and so on, and Timor, and they really didn't have any time to look after prisoners. So that the whole of the internal... Changi was a peninsula, and it was simply wired off at the bottom. Simply wired off at the bottom, and they were left, all these people, 20,000 or 30,000, whatever it was. And the British officers had to organise everything and maintain their own discipline. And initially, the diet was fantastically low. I can remember it was about 4 biscuits, army biscuits a day, with a little bit of marmalade or bully beef on them. There was no rice had been sent in, nothing, just what you carried in the wagon, one wagon you're allowed per unit. And I can remember saying to the MO that I was constipated. And he said, after you've been a fortnight constipated, he said, with the little amounts of food you're eating, come and see me. A fortnight. So that was the small amounts of food you had. That's absolutely right. Then they started sending rice in. Well, our cooks had never cooked rice in bulk before, so it was awful till they learned how to do it. Sloppy porridge stuff. And meanwhile, the English officers were still allowed to run the camps, run Changi. And I must say, I think they organised it fairly well. They imposed their own military discipline to keep up morale. And in fact, I have a copy somewhere, or not a copy, the original charge sheet that I took off a notice board when nobody was looking. A man was actually charged in a prison camp and given punishment by his own officers in the cause of discipline and morale. That I can find afterwards and show you if you wish. Quite interesting. Then they had the problems of toilets, kitchens, hospitals. The toilets were simply big earth augers, about a foot across, which the engineers used to dig down into the ground, maybe 20 foot deep, just put a little wooden hinged lid over the top if they could. And they got that system fairly hygienic and fairly good. Meanwhile, the Japs really still didn't bother about us for an awful long time, it seemed to me to be. We hardly saw any Japs. They were so busy letting you get yourself organised. But it seemed that they did have plans because, well, apart from that, there was one very sad incident I remember. It was really quite useless to try to escape because you're surrounded by water, Malaya, Burma, everything was thousands of miles away. But some did escape and were caught, and they brought them back. And I can remember the account. They made the officers, or certain officers and padres, go and watch these men dig their own grave, and they shot them. I can remember that happening. I didn't see it, but I can remember being told about it.
Do you think it's authentic?
Yes. Yes, I do, yes. Yes, I think that was authentic. I wouldn't have thought otherwise, no. Also, I can remember, because of the food problem, they found out that the grass, the lalang is the Malayan sort of grass, lalang, about this high, if you squashed it and compressed it, you got a horrible green liquid out of it. And this was very, very, absolutely full of vitamins.